Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I'll be speaking with Abraham Newman about his new book, co-written with Henry Farrell, called Of Privacy and Power, The Transatlantic Struggle Over Freedom and Security. We live in an interconnected world. People, goods, and services leap across borders like never before. Terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and digital platforms like Facebook have gone global. But if problems straddle different national jurisdictions, how do regulation and enforcement of policy even happen? Of Privacy and Power is a timely and wise analysis of globalization and how it has fundamentally changed governance. Digging into U.S.-European relations, Newman and Farrell show how businesses, activists, and policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic fought over and decided security and data policy. The book is also a call to action to their fellow IR scholars to study what Newman and Farrell call the international politics of information. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Abraham Newman, the co-author of Privacy and Power, the Transatlantic Struggle Over Freedom and Security. Thanks for joining me today, Abraham.
Thanks, Dexter. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, I've long been a fan of your and Henry Farrell's work, and I should let you know that you are the first political scientist that I've ever interviewed.
Well, I feel very honored.
Great. And so, just to begin the conversation, how did you become a political scientist?
You know, it was a weird story. I was my sophomore year in college, and I took a class that was about politics through the eyes of an artist, and I took that class, and then I started really getting into kind of political science, and I went to Germany. The original course was about the German politics, and I went to Germany. I was studying politics there. So, you know, it's kind of, I think of it as like a Virginia Woolf path to an academic field. You trip over one thing that leads you to another thing, and then there you are.
That's usually what happens. The book deals with sort of like an alternative way to theorize global politics and international political economy. And you and your co-author, Henry Farrell, call this the new interdependence approach. Can you just explain to listeners why you think this is a useful way to understand the world?
Totally. I think the standard story in political science and international relations in general is that there are these states that they sit in some kind of gelatin of anarchy where they're all separated from each other, and then they butt heads with each other. And in the US and European context, there was this famous book of Paradise and Power, and that's kind of, we're riffing off on the title, where Kagan, who was the author of that, he paints as this Mars versus Venus, the US versus Europe. And we were really dissatisfied with that picture because we think it totally ignores basically globalization, and that globalization has happened. And so what the book theoretically is trying to do is paint this alternative version of global politics in which actors are being challenged by multiple rules. If you're Apple or Facebook, you sit between US rules and European rules, and you don't really know, like, what should you do in order to make your business model work? And so at the same time, there are these new opportunities to assert your interests. And those are often not just national or domestic, they're transnational. And so we want to say that both the challenges that political actors face are not just domestic and national, and then their opportunities to advance their political preferences are often also at that transnational level. So it's a much more kind of complex and dynamic version of global politics that tries to take globalization seriously.
I'm a historian, and so I often ask historical questions. Could you pinpoint when the world started to look more like this, this world of the new interdependence approach?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a one moment where things happen, but you have an evolution that starts after the 1970s, where you start to get the free movement of capital. Capital controls go away, so finance becomes more globalized. You get container and global supply chains in the 1980s, where trade becomes much more globalized. And then you get communication networks that really start to take off in the 1990s. And I think all of these things, the embedding of finance, production, and communication in a global structure, then shifts how politics happens.
Great. Okay, so I want our listeners to come away with a good sense of this new interdependence approach. And so I think it might be annoying, but I think we should go through some of the key terms.
Sure.
Firstly, there are two conditions of this new interdependent system. And you've already alluded to at least one of them. So there's rule overlap and opportunity structures. Can you just give a quick definition for both?
Sure. So in our mind, the new interdependence approach, it starts with the idea that political actors are subject to multiple rule systems. And that is the idea that we call rule overlap. And that is kind of, we're contrasting that with the kind of the standard story that international relations is a world of anarchy, where there's no clear rules. And there, once you have this rule overlap, then actors face a lot of uncertainty, and they're looking to kind of resolve that. How can they understand which rules they're supposed to follow in the international system? So the second key part of our argument is the idea of opportunity structures, which is that the way that actors can resolve the uncertainty generated by rule overlap is not just in domestic political systems. It also can happen at the transnational or international level. And there, we're saying the opportunities that globalization presents for political actors are many and very variegated, and that they can happen at the global and international as well as the domestic.
Perfect. And finally, you named three different strategies that actors can pursue. And so there is defend and extend, cross-national layering, and insulation. So what do each of these mean, and why would a particular set of actors choose one over the others?
So the main point of the book is to think about what are the strategies that actors use if they're in this world where there is rule overlap and there are these new opportunity structures. And the most traditional, or the one that we think international relations has explored already, is the idea that actors try to defend and extend their current rules. And, you know, you see this all the time where a U.S. agency, let's take the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, they have a bunch of domestic rules about how stock exchanges function. And then they say, well, wouldn't it be easier if everybody else had these rules? And that kind of, you know, regulatory export, or sometimes people call it convergence, that's a standard story in international relations. But what we think is now happening are kind of these two other boxes that we focus on in most of the book. One of them is insulation strategies. And that's where actors, they don't have access to these global opportunity structures. They are kind of on the receiving end of these international forces. And they have to direct their policy activity, not just towards domestic policy battles, but to insulating themselves or protecting themselves from encroachments from the transnational level. And we can talk about it later, but a lot of what the privacy advocates are doing in our book is they're trying to prevent domestic rules from being undermined by these global policy initiatives. The cross-national layering, that's an idea where actors are unable to change their domestic rules. They're unsatisfied with them. They don't like, let's say, rules for the environment, rules for privacy, whatever the rule issue is. And so what they do is they create an alternative set of rules at the global level. And their goal is that those rules will, over time, come to unseat the domestic rules that had preexisted. And the reason why they can do that is because of rule overlap. Because domestic actors are facing uncertainty, they don't know what's happening with their domestic rules, and they're seeking some kind of, you know, more confidence in what the global rules should be. And so they latch on to these transnational rule structures that were layered on top of the domestic rules, and that then undermines support for the domestic rules over time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a lot of front-loading definitions. And so I think it's now a good opportunity to get into the book itself, get into the case studies. A part of your argument is that at least in terms of security, for the latter half of the 20th century, Europe and the U.S. had relatively autonomous policies. But then 9/11 was an event that really ruptured this mutual autonomy. And so one of the things that the U.S. did in the wake of 9/11 was pass a law that required foreign air carriers to provide U.S. customs with passenger information. And what's really fascinating about this is that if a European airline were to give up this information, they'd actually be in violation of European privacy laws. And so can you share with our listeners this story? And in particular, can you explain why we can't frame this as just another story of like a security-obsessed America versus privacy-obsessed Europe?
Definitely. So there's a series of cases in the book where we show how after 9/11, you get this, what we would call rule overlap, where the U.S. is basically making demands globally on actors to provide information, sensitive information, that other countries, in particular the European Union, they don't want to give up. And what we then show is that in many of these cases, the U.S. was not able to get these deals done domestically. So they were blocked from getting the information that they wanted at home. In the case of airline passenger data, for example, there were efforts to basically get the airlines to give over tons of data to the U.S. government. And these were often pushed back. And there was, the ACLU, other actors were quite good at blocking U.S. efforts domestically. And so here's a case where the U.S. couldn't get what it wanted domestically, and it went globally to do it. And it made foreign air carriers provide information to it. The thing that we want to stress is that Europe was not just a passive recipient of U.S. bullying. There are, both in the airline passenger data case, also in financial data, there were actors in Europe that were eager and wanted to be part of this transnational agreement because they also were blocked at home from getting access to a lot of data. And so by creating this cross-national layer, this transnational bargain, they were able to circumvent a lot of the barriers they faced domestically by working together transatlantically.
Mm-hmm. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit more? Like what exactly was this transnational arrangement that they developed? And how did this arrangement on a transnational scale then reverberate back in Europe and started to undermine European privacy laws?
Sure. So in the case of airline passenger data, what happened was first there was this PNR agreement, which what it was called, the passenger name record agreement between the US and Europe, which allowed European air carriers to supply information to the US customs. But then the European officials, they basically argued domestically that we're forced to comply with this American agreement, and to make it really work, and it's been so successful, now we need it at home too. And so they use that to justify a European version of the PNR agreement. And so it was a little bit of a fait accompli, you know, like there's this transnational agreement, it's working, it's great, and so now we should do it too. And then they were able to get that through as part of their kind of the political process of taking this transnational agreement and then domesticating it. In another case, the SWIFT agreement, that's where SWIFT is an organization that basically routes all global financial transactions. It sits in Europe. After 9/11, the U.S. made warrant requests from SWIFT to give it data on financial transactions. It led to a SWIFT agreement between the U.S. and Europe to allow these data transfers. And in that agreement, what's so interesting is that it includes a reciprocity clause in it that basically says SWIFT will give this data to the U.S. authorities, and European governments can make requests of the U.S. authorities for data that they want that they've given to the U.S. authorities. And so basically, European governments were blocked from getting access to much of the SWIFT data because of domestic privacy laws. But the agreement then gives the data to the U.S. authorities, and then European governments can query the U.S. government to get the data. It's a kind of like a policy laundering exercise where, you know, because they're blocked at home from getting the data because of domestic laws, they use that transnational agreement as a workaround.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, what's really interesting about that case is how national borders actually matter a lot because it's through the foreign that you can get domestic data. This is another case study in your book, and I think it's worth talking about a bit more. So SWIFT, the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, is, as you put it in the book, the digital backbone of the global financial services industry. And you've already given kind of a quick explanation of what it does, but can you just relay to our listeners how important SWIFT is?
Sure. So SWIFT, it's this organization. It's based in Belgium. It started in the 1970s, and before that time, if banks wanted to make a transaction, they had to basically use telegraph or telephone to confirm the transaction. And what SWIFT does is it provides a secure messaging service to basically all global financial institutions. And if you make a transaction that's more than $10,000 anywhere in the world, it's routed through the SWIFT system. So in the 1970s, when SWIFT started, there were about 3,000 messages a year. And now there are millions of messages a day that are routed through the system. So it has become really a focal institution in the global financial network.
Mm-hmm. And so this comes out of this book, but then also some of your other work on SWIFT. But a really interesting feature of its history is that since 9/11, the U.S. has tried to weaponize its position within the network. I would love for you to explain that to us.
Sure. So in current work that I'm doing with Henry, we're very focused on how global economic networks can be weaponized by states. And in the case of SWIFT, it's been for what we call a panopticon effect. So it's basically because all of this information is routed through this central source, if you can get access to that central source, then you have a viewpoint on the entire global financial system and how it's being used. And so after 9/11, the U.S. Treasury in particular, it woke up to this fact. And there's this great book called Treasury's War by Juan Zarate. And he was one of the actors at the Treasury at this time. And he talks about SWIFT as the kind of the Rosetta Stone for the fight against terrorism. It was a way for U.S. actors to have information that nobody else could really have access to.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Wonderful. And so another case study in your book does something a little bit different. And so if, you know, in the passenger name registry case and then the Swift case, we see strategies of defend and extend and cross-national layering, if I'm using it correctly. But then in this other case, you examine the strategy of insulation. And so in the wake of the Snowden leaks, there were privacy activists within Europe who pursued this strategy so as to insulate Europe from these transnational pressures to share information. And a recurring character in the story is the Austrian privacy advocate Max Schrems. And I think he's just an interesting actor to follow. So can you tell us who Max Schrems is and how he and others have pursued this strategy of insulation?
Definitely. So, you know, Max Schrems, he's both a lawyer and a privacy advocate who is based in Austria. But what he quickly realizes is that if he wants to secure privacy rights for European citizens, that he can't just play a domestic game. He starts and he's really focused on Facebook and being frustrated that he feels like Facebook is circumventing European privacy rules. And the way that they're doing it is this agreement that the US and Europe signed back in 2000 that was called the Safe Harbor Agreement. And the Safe Harbor Agreement was, you know, you have to remember that Facebook, Google, all of these companies are very new. The kind of internet-based economy is very new. And so in 2000, the US and Europe signed this agreement that let global companies access data from Europe as long as they pledged to meet European privacy laws. And Max Schrems argues, you know, that this was basically what we would call cross-national layering, that the Safe Harbor Agreement eats away at European privacy rules. These companies, they're not really following European law, and there's no direct redress for these privacy advocates to stop them because this agreement was signed. And so what we show in that part of the book is how Schrems uses the revelations that were made public by Edward Snowden to attack not Facebook in Austria, but to attack the Safe Harbor Agreement. And he basically combines, he integrates claims about national security concerns with the Safe Harbor Agreement. And he argues that, you know, the Safe Harbor Agreement has become not just a channel for Facebook to operate globally, but it's a channel for the NSA to get data on European citizens. And ultimately, the European Court of Justice, which hears that case, it rules in favor of his argument that the Safe Harbor Agreement has become not just a commercial agreement to facilitate trade, but has become a kind of a backdoor for U.S. agencies to get data on European citizens.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so something that I was really struck by reading your book was how older international organizations such as the UN NATO or others don't actually make much of an appearance in your book. You examine these other transnational arrangements and international organizations like SWIFT. What does that tell us about this interdependence that you're analyzing? And what might it say about those older international organizations?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. In a lot of the work that Henry and I do, we are focusing on types of globalization issues that have come about after what we would call the kind of the international liberal order really got going. And so, you know, when, let's say, the Bretton Woods system was created for kind of monetary politics, at that point, there were capital controls for global finance. And so those institutions weren't really built to think about a world of global finance. And so today, when you have issues about, let's say, SWIFT or secondary sanctions, or you know, any time where actors are using global finance in a strategic or geostrategic way, there aren't really international institutions that are there that can mediate that. Similarly, with the internet, you know, it was born after those institutions were created, and interestingly, the United States very actively prevented the relevant institutions from being involved. So if you think about the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, when the internet was born, the U.S. said, you know, we want this to be self-regulation. This shouldn't be about ITU. So either because of governance gaps, that there weren't any institutions originally, or sometimes because of actors acting strategically, the old guard international organizations are often not playing a key role in what we would think of as the core networks of globalization.
Yeah, I mean, well, actually, I didn't know that about the relationship between the ITU and the internet, but that's actually really interesting because in a certain sense, the U.S. is insulating its own practices from a very particular kind of global governance, but then by way of doing that, they're also extending their practices beyond its borders.
Definitely. I mean, the creation of ICANN, which was the major governance institution for the internet, that was an extension, a defend and extend strategy where the U.S. had kind of a private actor governance model for the internet, and it didn't want to give that up. The Department of Commerce for a long time was the kind of the granting authority that gave ICANN its legitimacy. And so it saw that as a mechanism of control, that a one country, one vote kind of organization like the ITU would dilute U.S. Power over internet governance. So I definitely think that that was a case where the U.S. was trying to defend and extend its model and push it out globally.
Mm-hmm. And so another interesting thread that I was following in your book is the location of where data was stored. And so this actually matters a lot from like a political standpoint. It matters because it calls attention to how the so-called cloud has always actually existed in particular jurisdictions. To be quite frank, it's been mostly in it's been mostly under a U.S. jurisdiction. And so in the case of the passenger data story, it turns out that most foreign air carriers had stored passenger data on U.S. servers, and that actually gave the U.S. some leverage over securing that information. And then as well, in 2018, Congress passed the U.S. Cloud Act. It gave the U.S. government access to data from U.S. companies that happened to be stored abroad. Can you say something about this connection between geography and data?
Sure. So one of the things that we explore in this book, but it's also something that we take up a lot in our current work on weaponizing interdependence, is the fact that the internet actually has a lot of what we would call choke points or points of centralization. So everybody thinks about the internet as this really messy thing. There's this famous quote by Bill Clinton. He's talking about the Chinese attempts to regulate the internet, where he says, regulating the internet is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. You know, it's impossible. But actually, when you look at the infrastructure of global information, it has quite a few points of centralization. So in the data storage area, Amazon Web Services and cloud services, you know, it provides most of the back end of most web pages. Right, if you're going to do cloud storage, it's going to be between Amazon and maybe Microsoft, you know, as two of the kind of core players. But even just on the actual like infrastructure of the internet, there are about 300 cables that provide most of the data communication globally. And so the thing, you know, we like to see it as this, you know, crisscrossing of all these bits globally. But when it comes down to it, there are these very few number of choke points that where the all the information flows. And there's a great visual, a slide in the Snowden documents. The NSA had a program that was called Storm Brew, and they the slide, it shows, you know, the 7 choke points of international communication, and it's focusing on these fiber optic cables that go underneath the oceans. But between that and the PRISM project, which also shows kind of how the NSA targeted a number of data services firms, it becomes clear that data is not randomly stored globally. It's concentrated in a very few number of places. And that geography is often a legacy of how Silicon Valley emerged. And it means that in many places, the United States has a lot of power because the data isn't randomly stored globally. It's concentrated in U.S. jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really hope that someone has borrowed the name Storm Brew for like their metal band or something. That is brilliant. Kudos to the authors of that name. So just getting to the conclusion of your book, it kind of outlines the ambitions of the book, and I might say it's an ambitious book. And so you want this book to help scholars rethink privacy concerns, information, and power. And so just to start us off, I would love to know why you think IR scholars have been so slow to study information and the international politics of information, as you put it.
You know, this is actually, it's like a huge conundrum for me. I don't really understand it. But the reality is that in the discipline of international relations, most scholars are either very focused on traditional military concerns, nuclear weapons, invasion, those kinds of questions of security, or in political economy, they're concerned with trade and very traditional versions of trade, like tariffs and trades in goods, or monetary politics. And for us, you know, it's like wake up, you know, like the world has been transformed. If you look at the stock exchange today, you know, the top 10 companies, they're all information technology companies. This is not the world of GE anymore. And so we need to really think about in the political economy front, how these companies are transforming economic relations. But as we try to show in this newer project on weaponized interdependence, that the security front is really being transformed by these companies and these you know, kind of transformation in how the world works in the same ways. So if you think about Russian disinformation or the panopticon argument that we make in about SWIFT, you know, these are cases where information flows are really being used to choke countries or to target adversaries.
Mm-hmm. I guess you were already nearing the end of your book, but like 2016 and and the subsequent sort of like scandals involving Cambridge Analytica and alleged Russian disinformation, all these things they almost kind of like wrote your book for you.
Yes, well, I mean we started this project a long time ago, so in the kind of late 2000s, and then we had two moments where we really had to kind of stop and just really assess what we were doing. One of them was when the Snowden revelations happened. And then the other was during the Russian disinformation and the Cambridge Analytica, those kinds of moments. But both of them were, they were very reaffirming for us about the importance of these issues, about the timeliness of the topic, and how people really need to pay more attention to this. That it's not just like a niche issue of quirky, data flows, but it's really at the core of what is democracy, how does democracy function, how do countries engage with each other, both cooperatively, but also in a more adversarial relationship, and that all actors, both, citizens, policymakers, they need to take these issues very seriously.
Uh-huh. What I really liked about the book was that you are including this really broad cast of characters or actors. At a certain point, you write that
sort of states, at least like the foreign policy wings of states, no longer have a diplomatic monopoly. That there are all these other actors that that are also engaged in these like transnational discussions and negotiating and all that. But it's not just that you included them; that you're also thinking about how they fit into this sort of like matrix of power. And so, this has really been what we've been talking about for the past half hour here. But how do globalization, information, interdependence transform the meaning of power?
Yeah, and there, I mean, I think what we want to argue is that there are many strategies that actors have in order to assert their interests, new opportunities that globalization opens up. And a lot of times it is about trying to resolve the contradictions that globalization creates for other powerful actors. And so because of that instability, because globalization is kind of shaking things up, it gives these, whether it's regulators or privacy advocates or the security community, they can come out and they can offer policy solutions that then resolve those frictions. And if they can do it in a, in an elegant way, they can really transform domestic rule structures and domestic politics. And so for us, power in the international system, it's not just about how many tanks you have, but it's about, can you create a cross-national coalition? Can you find allies that can develop these fait accomplis, these alternative rule structures that then flip the game?
I would love to know how you and Henry work together. So in history, co-writing is not as common as I think it's in political science. And so I'm just curious as to how two people write a book.
Yeah. We've had several projects before this that we've been writing on. And we kind of have like a little bit of a hive mind. We often we live in the same city, so that's lucky. And so we can meet at a coffee house and kind of map out a chapter of what's happening in there. And then one of us will barf out, as many ideas as we can. And then we toss it over to the other person and they refine it. And then sometimes we have to kind of step back and this isn't quite going in the direction that we want it to go. But it really is kind of a... we go back and forth with drafts, and we do everything on Dropbox. So we're just changing things back and forth. But I would call it it's been a very intellectually fulfilling collaboration.
You two are now working on another book, and we've sort of danced around the topic at various points in our conversation. But I would love to hear more about it. And So it's organized around the idea of weaponized interdependence. It deals with some of the same organizations like SWIFT that we've been talking about. So, yeah, can you say a bit more?
Sure. Both books are really about how globalization is transforming politics. And in the first book, we were kind of interested in how global networks create political opportunities for actors to forge these new coalitions, these new factions. And in the new book, we're looking at how the networks of globalization themselves become a political tool, how they can be weaponized against adversaries. And so the basic argument of the book, I've kind of already outlined a little bit, is that global economic networks are often not flat. We have this vision, Thomas Friedman had this metaphor, the world is flat. It really, in many global networks, finance, the internet, supply chains, there are these choke points. We're seeing that right now with the coronavirus and auto supply, supply chains, where they're all concentrated in a few cities, and they really force these choke points can break down how the supply chain networks work, or how global finance works, or the internet. And so, what the book looks at is how states, in particular, see new strategies to advance their power because of this, and in particular, the United States. And in the piece, we identify these two channels, the panopticon effect, which is really about surveillance and how actors that have access to these key choke points can glean really important information, and the other is how they can use it to deny access to adversaries, how they can box them out of those global networks.
That sounds really interesting, and I look forward to reading it. Just one more question. So you two are working in an area that is relatively new within IR. What has been the response from other IR scholars to your work? Is it contentious? Is it like, are there questions about whether this should even be included, or are people pretty tolerant and embracing?
You know, I think it's I think it's kind of a mixed bag where, you know, Henry and I, we started working on these topics in the late 90s. And at that time, I think our work was seen as kind of outsider work for most, you know, it wasn't fitting into a neat box of like, is this monetary policy? Is this trade policy? Is this security? What is this? That being said, Henry and I have been, you know, like we've been able to place articles in top journals. We've had books that have been published on these topics. And so we're not, I don't feel any way that like the community is really keeping us or gatekeeping us out of these topics. I do think that the world has made these things a priority and that scholars, you know, are now realize that these are kind of core to how international affairs works. And there's a lot more interest than when we started working on these topics.
I don't know whether that's like an entirely good thing that the world has forced these things into veritable topics.
It's a good thing. Henry and I always joke that like, you know, it's good for us. I don't know if it's it's good for the world, but yeah.
But I mean, it's what the two of you have been focusing on is something that for sure more scholars need to be focusing on. Abe, I really want to thank you again for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
It was great talking to you, Dexter. I really appreciate the time and also the interest you've shown for the book and the project.
And I've been speaking with Abraham Newman, who alongside Henry Farrell wrote Of Privacy and Power, The Transatlantic Struggle Over Freedom and Security. And you've been listening to New Books in History, a channel with the New Books Network.